Well, good morning, church. It's good to see all of you. If you would open your Bible to Mark chapter 5, that's going to be our topic and text for studying this morning. As we continue to worship the Lord through his word. While you're turning there, I just want to ask you a question about your worldview. Do immediate categories come to mind as you think about your worldview? What are those core truths that help you put the world together, that help you make sense of life, of history? And you may not have ready categories that are immediately leaping to mind, but the point is that the Bible isn't just a collection of stories, even true stories. It's not simply a place where we find important aspects of history and the history of God's work among his people. It's neither simply a book that collects principles that we're supposed to live by as Christ followers. The Bible presents to us a comprehensive view of the world. It presents to us a worldview. It puts the world together for us in a way that we're able, increasingly as we become more and more familiar with God's word, to answer big questions, the big questions of life that people have been wrestling with for thousands of years. So questions like, who am I? The Bible fills in this basic building block of what a worldview is. Questions like, why am I here? What's my purpose? So my identity, who am I? My purpose, why am I here? The problem, what's wrong with the world? As we look out, we watch the news, we're all coming up with conclusions about what's wrong with the world. The Bible gives us a firm answer to what's wrong with the world. And not only that, but remedy, not just problem, but remedy. How is the wrong supposed to be made right? Those are basic approaches to how do we fill up a Christian worldview, a biblical worldview that informs the way that we live. Beyond that, how do we define beauty versus ugliness? How do we define truth versus falsehood? How do we define good versus evil? So the Bible presents these things to us. A biblical worldview informs these massive categories out from which we live our whole lives. And so it informs those categories, and then those categories inform very much the way that we live. Good versus evil. Just think about that for a second. Speaking of evil, back in right after 9/11, some of you may remember, right after that event, President Bush was speaking of a coalition of hostile forces in the world, which he famously dubbed the Axis of Evil. That particular point, there were all kinds of differences in our life as a country about foreign policy and how we were supposed to engage with these hostile powers that he referred to as the Axis of Evil. But the phrase Axis of Evil was a dream come true for comedians, comedy writers everywhere, because they just rode the wave of that phrase, Axis of Evil. Even people around my office, I worked in a government office at the time, and they would all say the word evil with this fake tremor in their voice, like the Axis of Evil. And everybody was having fun with this. Spinning out of there were a number of things. Saturday Night Live had a sketch on this involving Will Ferrell. Then there was the Axis of Weasels, a satirical phrase mocking certain countries that didn't support the U.S. and the United Kingdom in the invasion of Iraq in 2003. There was the Axis of Medieval, mockingly criticizing President Bush for his religious beliefs making their way into his political policy. And then there were the Axles of Evil, denouncing sport utility vehicles for their poor fuel efficiency. Everybody was having fun with this. And then there was, in 2003, a Norwegian record label published a CD called Lullabies from the Axis of Evil, containing 14 lullabies from Iran, Iraq, North Korea, Palestine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Cuba. And every lullaby was sung by someone from one of those places, and then there were Western versions translated into English. But when explaining this phrase and why this phrase was crafted and included in the statements that were made after 9/11, this particular man named Michael Gerson, former White House speechwriter, said this, quote, "When dealing with an ideology that inspires beheadings and mass murder, the English language only offers so many words that carry sufficient moral weight. Evil and death are two of them." But we don't live in a morally serious culture, do we? But we have our moments. We have our moments where, as a culture, as a people, we look together in solidarity, we look together on some act of brutality, some act of greed or violence, and we see those things, and just if only for a moment we sober up, if only for a moment we reckon with a world that is filled with evil, and we view the concept of moral depravity as something more than a concept, and it wipes the smirks off of our faces and the cynical smiles off of our faces, and if for only a moment of sort of suspended criticism and cynicism, we might actually believe in angels and demons. We might actually believe in powers and principalities, in heaven and hell. The Bible presents to us a worldview, a view of the world that presents more to us than what meets the eye. It fills the world up with these realities, these kinds of things, taking his inspiration from C.S. Lewis's famous work called The Screwtape Letters. Randy Alcorn more recently wrote his own version of that called Lord Falgren's Letters. If you're familiar with The Screwtape Letters, it's basically a senior demon coaching a younger novice demon in how to really dupe people, how to deceive people, how to distract and destroy faith. Well, Lord Falgren's Letters follows the same approach, and in it, you can hear this conversation play out between a senior demon and a younger novice demon, and it plays out this way. The senior demon says, "Consider whom we're dealing with here. This virus on the galaxy, these parasites called image bearers, are so ignorant. They imagine the cosmos is limited to what they can see and hear and taste, touch, and smell. The rest of the universe, 99.999% of all reality in their puny mind, simply doesn't exist. Can you imagine? They're like those slimy babies in their vermin mother's womb, never suspecting that there's a vast world beyond the realm of their senses." C.S. Lewis wrote these words, "There is no neutral ground in the universe. Every square inch, every split second is claimed by God and counterclaimed by Satan." This is an essential part of the biblical worldview. You cannot read the Bible and not see these kinds of evaluations of what reality is and what's inside the real world. The Apostle Paul famously wrote these words, "We do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God." And Mark chapter 5 presents us with this same worldview. It presents the ministry of Jesus in a way that reinforces this understanding of the world. So beginning in Mark chapter 5, in verse 1, follow along as I read. "They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and bruised himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him, and crying out with a loud voice, he said, 'What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me.' For he was saying to him, 'Come out of the man, you unclean spirit.' And Jesus asked him, 'What is your name?' He replied, 'My name is Legion, for we are many.' And he begged him earnestly not to send him out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him, saying, 'Send us to the pigs, let us enter them.' So he gave them permission, and the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and were drowned in the sea. The herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country, and people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind. And they were afraid. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs. And they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. But he did not permit him and said to him, 'Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. Now, we might come to this text or away from this text from several angles and several levels of depth. I suppose at the most superficial level, the absolute most superficial level, this is painful to read for bacon lovers, because down into the sea go just piles and piles of just so much waste, right? So much waste. But you move up, actually I joke, but seriously, Bertrand Russell, the famous British philosopher of the late 1800s, born in the late 1800s, actually included this as one of his reasons for not believing in Jesus. He wrote a book called Why I Am Not a Christian. And in his list of all the kinds of things that he critiqued about the Christian faith, this was one, namely the pigs, the dying pigs, just wasted lives, wasted lives. And he looks over that and he just says, there's no way I can believe that Jesus is a moral teacher in light of what he did there. So at the most superficial level, we could fixate on the pigs, the dead pigs, right? But to move up a level or two or three from there would be to view this as just a manual for exorcism. A sort of step-by-step process of how to evict evil spirits from a person's life. So you come on the scene and you identify, you engage the evil spirit, you ask for its name, and then you command it to leave and so on. But if that's the primary takeaway we're supposed to have, I mean, that has a fairly limited application for us, right? And you keep that in your back pocket for the occasion when you might bump into somebody with superhuman strength inhabited by hosts of evil spirits that do the talking for them. Which isn't to say that there's no such thing as demon possession, but simply to say that that's not something that we're not encountering Mark chapter 5 on a day in, day out kind of basis. We're not seeing people breaking chains apart and shrieking on the mountainside. That's not a reality that we're constantly living in. And so, but I think the payoff is actually bigger and broader. It includes that, but it's bigger and broader than that. This passage is for every single person in this room. This passage shows us Jesus, the King. It's a picture of the King that we need as people living in this world, the King who is able to conquer the evil that we all in solidarity see around us. We see a King who is able to rescue the oppressed, not only the oppressed in this particular stripe, but the oppressed of all possible categories where evil brings us down and renders us immobile and powerless to change our situation. God the King, Jesus the King, comes on the scene. And beyond that, not only is Mark 5 have personal application for our own personal lives, but I think there's a bigger story there as well. I think this passage is a window into the story of the world, the story of the cosmos, God's grand narrative that moves from Genesis to Revelation, moving from creation to fall to redemption to the consummation of all things at the end of time. In other words, it's a worldview text. It fills up and populates these categories of what's wrong with the world and how can that wrong be made right. And this story presents to us a world that is obviously bent. Mark doesn't explain how it got bent, but he assumes that it is bent, and we see portraits of that. As a matter of fact, right here at the beginning, we see a portrait of humanity twisted. Humanity twisted. As you read through the Gospels, Mark is no different. It's impossible to miss the fact that Jesus' life and ministry were constantly bumping into opposition. Conflict was just a mark of every day of his existence. He's bumping into opposition. So right here in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is baptized in chapter 1. He comes up out of the water, and there's no honeymoon phase at all. It is on from that very moment. Opposition and hostility begin immediately. Comes up out of the water, and he's taken away to the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. He returns from the wilderness. He goes to the temple. In chapter 1, verse 23, says, immediately there was in the synagogue a man with an unclean spirit. I mean, it is on from the very beginning, and it doesn't get any easier from there. Matter of fact, in the chapter right before the one that we just read, in chapter 4, they almost all lose their lives to this just convulsive storm that breaks out in the Sea of Galilee, and they're all afraid, and they think they're going to die. And that's just a boat ride across the Sea of Galilee to come to this man who's from Gerasene. And so if we didn't have the rest of the Bible, we only had these opening chapters of Mark, it would help us begin to try to make sense of the world that we live in, and immediately we would grasp the fact that this world is broken, that there is something seriously wrong in the world. Barren wastelands and demonic temptations and demonic oppression and possession and illness and leprosy, and we haven't even gotten out of Mark chapter 1 before all of those things have all become realities that we're looking at. We ask the question, where did all this hostility, where did all this disorder and brokenness come from? Well, again, Mark doesn't tell us the origin of it. He assumes that it's there. Genesis 3, however, explains the origin of all this brokenness and disorder in the world. In Genesis 3, just an important text for us to know as Christ followers, because it fills in this massive part of our worldview, namely the fall. What's wrong with the world and how did it get there? And Genesis 3 unpacks that for us. It explains the fall of Adam and Eve, tempted by the serpent in the garden. They rebelled against God, and this brought a whole new set of unwelcome realities into the world. There was instantly a new normal. Instantly, marital conflict breaks out. They're pointing fingers and blaming one another. Instantly, there's frustration at work as Adam is cultivating the field. Instantly, there's pain in childbirth. Children whose default setting is disobedience rather than obedience. Parents, didn't take very long to discover, right, that the default setting of our children is not obedience, it's disobedience. They have to be taught how to obey. They don't have to be taught how to disobey. We never have to teach them the word no. Somehow they just internally come up with that. Just draw it right out of Genesis 3, which is so deep down there. They pull that right out, right? The world itself becomes generally uncooperative, right? So Adam goes to do the job that he had done the day before the fall, and he sticks the shovel in, and it's almost as though the earth itself says no. So he starts sweating, and then thorns and thistles are here. What is this? This is a new, unwelcome reality brought along by the fall. And not only that, Scripture begins to tell us that there's something deeper. It's not just in our external environment and in our relationship. The mind, our own minds and our own will have been affected by the fall. Romans chapter 1, verse 21 and 22. Maybe you've heard this before. Although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to become to be wise, they became fools. Romans chapter 8 talks about the same sort of thing. It speaks of the fallen human mind, apart from the grace of God and regeneration, the fallen human mind as being hostile to God. The Apostle Paul's language, it's hostile to God. It will not submit to God's law, and it, he says, cannot submit to God's law. There's an internal hostility against God's word. 1 Corinthians chapter 2. I mean, we could look at tons of passages, but 1 Corinthians chapter 2 talks about the natural person, apart from the power of God and the new birth. Paul says, the natural person does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him. Having been made in God's image with a mind and will and capacities to love and enjoy God, that's Genesis 1 and 2, we rebelled and something was broken. And so when our first parents made a grab for godness, which is what happened in the garden, it wasn't just a piece of fruit, it was a grab for godness. You eat this and you will become like God. It's not that they were just hungry and therefore curses ran through the world. It's that they wanted to be God. They wanted a throne. And when they grabbed for godness, not only did they not get the godness, they lost their humanity. There was a break, an internal break in the wiring that we were made in God's image, but that became distorted right there immediately. They became less human. In our culture, we often equate being human with sinning. You know, I'm only human. Matter of fact, that was a song. I grew up hearing this song. I'm only human. This is this chorus that he writes. This man apparently had been unfaithful. And the chorus of the song is, I'm only human, flesh and blood I'm made. I'm only human, born to make mistakes. I can only imagine this song meant for reconciliation. I bet it didn't work. Because it's a clinic on how to apologize but not apologize. Look, this happened and it's so bad, but it was pretty much inevitable. I mean, I'm human. We think about it that way, but that's not the way it was from the beginning. That's not God's definition of what it means to be human. We were made in the image of God with a capacity, a will, a heart, an ability to relate to him, to walk with him in the cool of the garden, to give ourselves in submission to his lordship and his benevolent rule over the world, over our lives. That's the way it was, and we enjoyed him there in the garden before the fall. That's what it meant to be an image bearer, made male and female in his own image. He created them. In other words, had there not been Genesis 3, we would not be reading Mark 5. But because there was Genesis 3, we are reading Mark 5. And we're not only reading Mark 5, but we can see aspects of this world filled up as it is with spiritual activity, cosmic powers, angels and demons. We can see that real evil in the world around us. I mean, just think about that. Had it not been for Genesis 3, words like disease, famine, cancer, tsunami, natural disasters, abuse, trafficking, those words would literally mean nothing to us. They would have no content. It would be like so many of the words in Dr. Seuss's writings, zizzer, zazzer, zuzz. That would be the word. Death would be just like zizzer, zazzer, zuzz. You would say, what does that mean? Death, what does famine mean? Genesis 3 changed everything in this world, so it belongs in our worldview, the way in which we view the world. Now back to the story. So Jesus and his disciples, right here in verse 2, they land on the eastern shore of Galilee, and it says, verse 2, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. And when it describes this man, it basically portrays him as inhuman. If you lived in this village, you would be familiar with the stories associated with this man. This man who was up there, up in the hill country, on the steep hills, and in the caves. By the way, archaeologists have discovered that just within a mile inland of this place, Gergesa, this region, they have found cave tombs that confirm the story of Mark chapter 5. So it really happened. There really were places there. And this man was just kind of roaming around the mountains, and that's the person who comes to Jesus. Right here at the beginning of our text, you imagine this, just the townspeople hearing him up there, shrieking all night long, crying throughout the day and throughout the night. This would have been something they were all familiar with, stories. Maybe the kids told it around the campfire. They would tell stories about just that beast of a man up there shrieking in the mountains. They would have been so familiar with this. And if you had the nerve to actually approach this region, this cave tomb region, you would have found, according to Mark, you would have found broken, shattered chains, shackles, which would tell a story about the community seeking to do their best to come around and rein him in, bring him back. Futile attempts, broken shackles all around the hillside. In Mark 5, we see very much our enemy flaunting his power. And this is a showcase. This is an exhibition. He is laying it all out there and saying, look what I can do to this man who used to be made in the image of God. More often, though, I think that we see the enemy's work in far more subtle ways. Equally powerful, but not as manifest, not as flaunting kinds of ways. I had a conversation with a man named Alex in 2010. Had I known the nature of the conversation, we wouldn't have met at a restaurant, but we met at a restaurant, and as soon as he sat down and introduced himself, and he didn't smile through the entire meeting, and he was trembling. You could see him trembling there. And he told a story about how back in 2007, just a few years before that, he said, I was just a normal kid. He was in college while I'm meeting with him. He said, I was just a normal kid. Not a problem child, did well in school, obedient to my parents. And he said, in 2007, I woke up and suddenly there were thoughts assaulting my mind. And they were predicting things about my future, what I was going to be, the horrible things that I was going to do in my life. And initially he said, as the day wore on, he just thought, this is really aggravating, this is really annoying. And he said, he woke up the next day and as soon as he opened his eyes, the thoughts pounding all day until he went to sleep. A year and a half later, the same thing was happening on a daily basis. He started to pull out of relationships, isolate himself. He wouldn't go anywhere. He couldn't enjoy anything. He just lived by himself in isolation. And he said, then he found himself in a hotel lobby. He said, I looked next to me. He wasn't raised a believer. He didn't know anything about the gospel. He looked next to him and he saw a Gideon Bible. He said, I picked up the Bible. Didn't even know the books that were in the Bible. He flipped it open to Matthew, began reading the gospels. And he said, for the first time, silence. Absolute silence in his thoughts. All those assaulting voices immediately stopped. And he said, so I thought, I'm just going to keep reading. And he began a daily regimen of reading the Bible, and the voices weren't there, day after day after day, until December of 2009. Here, he and I were meeting in the beginning of 2010, December of 2009, and the voices came back. And he said, I was so discouraged and so crushed by the fact that they were back. He said, Matt, he leaned over, tears filling his eyes. And he said, Matt, I cursed the Holy Trinity. What's going to happen to me? I'm not in some ancient mountainous village. I'm at Chick-fil-A in Metairie, Louisiana, on Veterans Boulevard. The world is shot through with evil. There are real powers at work in and on the mind and in and on the heart. And the Bible insists that we not view this world in a materialistic kind of way, in this superficial sort of way. We can't reduce our world to just biology and chemistry and physics. It's way more than that. Matter of fact, any worldview that leaves God out of the equation is bankrupt because it cannot account for evil in this world, or good for that matter. It cannot account for evil or good. There is no goodness and there is no evil if all we have is scientific naturalism as our worldview. It can't be. I mean, all we are, if scientific naturalism as a worldview is correct, then all you see when you look around is what protoplasm does to other protoplasm at these altitudes and under these conditions. That's all you see. You see nothing good. You see nothing beautiful. You see nothing evil. You just see protoplasm doing what it does. A biblical worldview, however, convinces us otherwise. It lets us see real tragedy, real brokenness, real evil, real grace, real rescue, real supernatural power. Imagine this man's parents in Mark 5. Isn't it heartbreaking? You just think about the heartache of having to watch their son escorted out into the hillsides to live among the dead. And that's your boy. He's removed from all relationships. He's removed from all possible remedy, religious or medical or otherwise. He is without hope. He is without love. He is without God in this world. And you're his parents, and you hear the rumors as people are walking along the hillsides with their herds of pigs or whatever they might be doing, and they hear him shrieking, and people come down and they sit at the table next to you, and you hear them mumbling and saying, guess who I saw? I saw the demoniac from Gergesa. And you hear these rumors, and they all have the same sorts of things in common, the same observations. He was naked, and he was crying, and he was cursing, and he was cutting himself with stones. And this inhuman creature comes running to Jesus in the opening verses of Mark 5. And when he reaches him, something interesting happens. He immediately falls down before Jesus. And this demonic spokesperson representing the others speaks out in verse 6. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him, and crying out with a loud voice, he said, what have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me. Interesting. The demons know exactly who Jesus is. Surely this must be what was in James's mind later in the New Testament when he said, the demons believe and they tremble. The demons know. Yeah, you say you have faith, so do the demons. They believe and they tremble. And this demon believes and he trembles and he recognizes exactly who Jesus is. He didn't need an introduction. Jesus didn't need to say, hey, look, let's just be clear. I'm the Son of the Most High God. None of that happened. The demons just instinctively knew. Unlike John the Baptist, who had to send his delegation, kind of his fellows, to go, and they came and they asked Jesus the question, are you the one or should we look for another? Unlike that. Unlike the Pharisees who said and asked the question, if you're the Christ, tell us plainly. Demons don't need to ask any of those questions. They come on the scene saying, what have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Not only do they know the identity of Jesus as the Son of the Most High God. They seem to have a working grasp of biblical eschatology. They seem to have a working grasp of what happens at the end of time and how this Jesus connects to the destiny of ruling and reigning in the world. They identify that he is the one. He must be the one who is going to bring judgment against all evil. They're not questioning the end of evil. They know that's coming. They're pleading that that moment not be right now. There's not a debate, an eschatology debate about what's going to happen in the future with demons and evil with respect to Jesus. They know that's coming. They're just simply saying, please let that not be now. Please don't torment us before the time. Jesus, we know from reading the rest of the New Testament, Jesus isn't here to bring about the end of evil in an absolute kind of ultimate way. He's going to do that in his second coming. But in this first coming, in this encounter, we will see a kind of preview of that day. You know how you go to the movies and you see the full version, but you see the preview that comes first? This is a preview. This is a window into the future of what Jesus will do in an ultimate and global way when he returns. And what we see next in our passage is humanity reclaimed. Humanity reclaimed. We see the kingship of Jesus is all over our passage, and it's all over Mark's gospel. Jesus is large and in charge from the beginning of this gospel all the way to the end, and he is king. In Mark 5, he's king from the moment his feet touch the shores of Gergesa in the very beginning, and he's king until he gets back in the boat and leaves this man there on the shore changed. Absolutely changed from top to bottom. Jesus is king. It's these kinds of texts that cause Martin Luther to say famously, the devil is God's devil. What he meant by that is that there's no even-handed contest between Jesus and Legion. It's not like they hit him, and then he hits back, and then they hit him, and then he hits back twice, and it's over. No, there's no back and forth. Jesus comes. He says, out. They say, where? He says, how about the pigs? They go into the pigs. The pigs drown, and it's game over. The devil is God's devil. God is in charge. They're asking permission. The demons are saying, is it okay? Have you come to torment us? No. Okay, is it okay if we go to the pigs? We know you're going to drive us out. Can we go over there? They do exactly what they're told. Throughout this text, Jesus is in charge. He is king all over this text. And the incarnation of Jesus, we really should view this, all of Jesus' ministry in the Gospels, view the incarnation of Jesus in one sense as a display of the compassion of God. Oh, but in another sense, view it as a brazen act of aggression against the devil. Oh, Jesus is brazenly and aggressively going after the enemy. John the Baptist introduced Jesus this way. When he rolled out the red carpet, he said, guess what? The king is coming. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. The axe is laid to the root of the tree and the whole thing is coming down. The king is coming here now. Jesus picked up this very same language. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. Jesus tells a story in Mark chapter 3. He tells a story in Luke chapter 11. And he says, let me just tell you how you take something from someone who's strong. One, you have to be stronger. Luke 11, a stronger man comes into the house of the strong man, ties up the strong man, and then plunders him and robs him dry. Jesus uses that as an illustration of what he's going to be doing left, right, and center throughout the Gospels. It's Jesus saying, that's what I'm going to do. That's what I did today. That's what I'll do tomorrow. I'll walk into his house. The prince of the power of the air. I'll come in the incarnation to his house. I'll tie up the strong man and I'm gonna rob him blind. All day tomorrow, all day on Tuesday, all day on Wednesday. That's what Jesus does. He's the king. Consider Jesus' first sermon. He intros this. He states it right there at the beginning. All the whole Bible reading plan is laid out there before him. And of all the texts he chooses, he picks the scroll with Isaiah chapter 61 on it. And he says, this is the perfect intro to my ministry. And he reads these words. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he's anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives, recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed. John tells us, 1 John 3:8, exactly why Jesus came. We don't need to wonder, why did he come? Did he have multiple purposes? And yes, he did, but John makes it very clear. This is an aspect, a critical, essential part of Jesus' mission. The reason the Son of God appeared, 1 John 3:8, the reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the works of the devil. That's why he was here. You want to know why Jesus shouted on the shores of Gergesa? Why? Because he was here on a rescue mission. He was here to set at liberty the ones who were oppressed. These encounters in the Gospels that Jesus has with evil, they didn't surprise him. It's not like he gets to the shore of Gergesa and says, wait, people can be filled with demons? What is going on here? He knew this was happening. This didn't surprise him one bit. But I believe that it vexed his soul. As the Son of God and the Son of Man, I believe it vexed his soul to walk around in the earth that he made and see the residue of a dark enemy in all directions, to see evil and destruction shot through this world that was made, and it was pronounced everything was good in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. And now everywhere he turns as he ministers in the Gospels, everywhere he turns, he sees evidence of a vandal in God's world, a distorter in God's world, and he is making an absolute mess of the place. And so Jesus shouts at demons. And he shouts at wind and waves. It's the same word, rebuke, in Mark chapter 4 toward the wind and waves. It's the same word that he uses when he's speaking to the demoniac in Mark chapter 1. He rebukes these convulsions in God's good world, and he sees tokens, evidence of the fall all around him, and it chafes him deeply. John chapter 1 tells us Jesus was there on day one of creation. The world was made through him. He was there when the Father looked over it all and pronounced a benediction and said, it's all, every part of it, every blade of grass, every tree, every creature, it's all very good. And Jesus is standing there at the Father's right hand on the moment of that benediction. There were no shrieking demoniacs in the Garden of Eden in Genesis 1 or 2. There were no self-inflicted wounds. There were no tsunamis. There were no life-threatening storms. Created nature and human nature were both under the good rule and order of God before the fall. There were no orphanages in Eden. No conversations in which people are eating salad and discussing the market value of baby body parts. Not in Genesis 1 and 2. Genesis 3, yes. Not at the beginning. And Jesus knows the origin. He knows the origin of all sin, abuse, famine, trafficking, disease, misery. The serpent deceived them in the garden. Adam and Eve rebelled in the garden, and this set the wheels of death and destruction and disorder into motion. And the whole world was bent. The whole world was distorted in a fundamental kind of way. And here's Jesus in Mark chapter 5, and he's looking into the face of someone who used to be a recognizable human being. And now he's just a passive host inhabited by devils and barely resembling anything human. And Jesus sees this, and the king came to set at liberty those who were oppressed. He came to Gergesa, to quote from Psalms, he came because God executes justice for the oppressed. The Lord sets the prisoners free. He came, Psalm 102, verse 20, he came because God hears the groans of the prisoners, to set free those who are doomed to die. You think about that. You read Mark chapter 5 and you see the Son of the Most High God, and he heard this howling demoniac up in the hillside and among the tombs, and Jesus came. Unless we think that this is just a neat story about what he does for people who are more deeply troubled than the rest of us, no, we're all over this. Lest we think that this chapter is about someone utterly unlike you. Oh, hear what God's word says. You were dead in the trespasses and sins in which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air. You might not have even believed there was such a thing as the prince of the power of the air, but guess what? You were following him all day, every day. You were loving darkness rather than light. This is my verse. This is my story and your story. Following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that's now at work in the sons of disobedience, among whom we all once lived in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the body and the mind. And we, every person in this room, were by nature children of wrath, like the rest of mankind. And the two greatest words in the Bible, but God. But God. You were a slave to sin, Christian friend. A slave to sin. Jesus said as much. He said, whoever sins is a slave of sin. You believe what Jesus says? He says you were a slave. You might not have felt, you might have felt you were in control of all your faculties, fully doing what you wanted to do. You were in fact a slave according to Jesus. 2 Timothy chapter 2 speaks of humanity, fallen humanity as, quote, held captive by Satan to do his will. Listen to this quote from Sinclair Ferguson, a New Testament scholar who speaks about Mark chapter 5. He writes, Legion's story records in capital letters what is true of all men by nature. We are slaves of evil. We are bent ultimately on self-destruction. Neither we ourselves nor others are capable of breaking the powers which have bound us. Christ alone can break the power of sin in our lives and set us free. That's why I said at the outset of our time of study that this text is about far more than dying pigs, and it's far more than manuals on how to exorcise someone who's inhabited by devils. This is a window into the nature of salvation. It's a window into the story of God and sinners. It shows us these realities. Do you feel your need for rescue? Well, think about it. Think about it very personally. When you think about the problem of evil, is it all outside of you, or are you on the inside of the problem of evil? Are you objective, kind of looking from the grandstands down at that problem of evil and all the institutions and structures of government and all the rest, but here you are aloof, distant from all of it, or are you inside the problem needing help to come from outside? That's the heart of the gospel, that the Savior comes from outside, inside, to bring us to God, to rescue us from sin, from the darkness that would hold us forever. Philosopher and author G.K. Chesterton, born in the late 1800s, responded to an article that was written in the British Times. The article was entitled, What's Wrong with the World? And Chesterton responded to that, and his response was published in the next week's paper. He wrote these words, Dear sir, in response to your article, What's Wrong with the World? I am yours truly, G.K. Chesterton. Is that how you think? Does that fit your worldview? Are you on the inside of the problem of evil, needing help from the outside of the problem of evil, the Savior who comes into an evil world and rescues evil people? Do you say, What's wrong with the world? I'm what's wrong with the world. The story of the Bible, the story of redemptive history is this. God made us in his image to know him, to enjoy him, to glorify him. We disobeyed and we lost something of our humanity, and Jesus comes to remake us human, to remake us, to reclaim us as image bearers so that we reflect God, so that we are, that's what Christian New Testament talks about. Full formation is us coming into the image, being conformed into the image of the one true human, Jesus, fully man, fully God. The story of the Bible is creation, fall, and recreation through the person and work of the truest human being who ever lived, through Jesus, his death, his resurrection from the grave, and our faith in him. In other words, through Jesus, there's a new template for humanity. There's a way out of the broken template of humanity. There is a new way to be human. If anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. Old things have passed away. Behold, all things have become new. There's a new Genesis, a re-Genesis. Christian theology uses the term, a regeneration, new life, new desires, freedom in Jesus. And Jesus doesn't just show us what it's like to live and to be fully human. He doesn't just show us what it's like to dedicate heart, soul, mind, and strength to the glory of God and to the enjoyment of God forever. No, he doesn't just show us that in a kind of example way. Try this at home. He makes it possible. Through our union with Jesus, it's possible to go down in death as we celebrate in baptism week after week. It's possible to die and to live again. It's possible to say and to quote Galatians chapter 2, verse 20, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. In the life that I now live, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. What Jesus does in Mark chapter 5 is a visible signpost pointing to what he does in the heart of every person who puts their trust in him. Total renovation. Freedom through the grace and power of God. And what Jesus does in Mark 5 is a scale model of what he'll do in Revelation 19 through Revelation 20 when evil is put down once and for all. Which brings us to our last scene in our text, namely humanity revealed. Humanity revealed. You know, we never learn this man's real name. We just know him as the one they used to call Legion. I imagine he didn't stick with that name. I wouldn't recommend it. Just move on, maybe pick another name, right? But we never do find out what his name was. But in verse 19 and 20, it shows this man rescued by God living as one reclaimed as an image bearer. He is brought full circle. He is shrieking in the mountainside at the beginning of this chapter. And look what he's doing at the end. Verse 19, Jesus did not permit him, but said to him, go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. Verse 20, and he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. Jesus' power brings this man full circle. You know, when you back up, word had gotten out that he had been rescued, and all the townspeople, they all start running to the scene, and they see this former demoniac, the text says, clothed and in his right mind. That's how we knew he was naked earlier, because now they actually, it's noteworthy that he has clothes on. He's clothed and in his right mind. But notice their response in verse 15. They don't say, oh, wow, he's got clothes on. Oh, wow, he's sane. Oh, wow, he's not inhabited by devils. They're not relieved. It says they were afraid. Look at verse 17. And they began to praise Jesus for what he had done, beg Jesus to depart from their region. Strange things are happening all over this text, right? So they see this demoniac rescued, a miracle of God's compassion, and they're afraid, and they beg Jesus to leave. So what's going on here? Well, it could be the fear of the holy. You realize you're standing in the presence of the holy God. That's what happened in Mark chapter 4. The end of Mark chapter 4, the disciples are terrified because they think that they're going to die, and so they're afraid of the waves. And then Jesus rebukes the waves and stills them, and the text says, and they were greatly afraid. You would think that the text would say, and they were greatly relieved because they'll live to hit the shoreline. But they were greatly afraid. And what's that associated with? Look at the last verse in chapter 4. They were filled with great fear and said to one another, who then is this that even wind and sea obey him? So you realize you're standing in the presence of God the Most High, and suddenly you feel very awkward, very antsy. Let's get him out of here. I don't feel comfortable. What will happen next? There's a loss of control, right? In that moment, the townspeople are like, I'm not sure what to do with this. And so they invite him to leave. Other scholars will comment and speculate that perhaps the people asked him to leave because they were upset about what happened with the pigs. That was their livelihood. Remember, I mean, these pigs were not domestic pets. This was livelihood. This was business. And the people who came and reported to the town what had just happened were, verse 14, the herdsmen. So they had a particular tilt on things. They couldn't have been very happy about what happened. So that's a possibility as well. Can't be sure, but notice two things are absolutely sure. One, the people ask Jesus to leave. The townspeople ask Jesus to leave, and he packs up. Don't ask Jesus to leave. Ask him to stay. They ask Jesus to leave, and he climbs in the boat. And something even more ironic is the former demoniac asks if he can join Jesus, and he's denied. Two twists in the plot. The language here in this verse, in verse 18, begged him that he might be with him. That language is used in Mark chapter 3 in respect to Jesus collecting the disciples as his followers. It says that he chose them and named them apostles that they might be with him. It's the exact same language. It's a technical description of what it means to accompany Jesus on mission, to go with Jesus, to be where he is, to sleep where he sleeps, to go where he goes, to stay where he stays. That's what happens here. So why is Jesus denying this man access to live with him, to go with him where he goes? I think one of the answers is this, that Jesus, quite simply, we read this text and we realize Jesus doesn't do ministry the way that we think he does, or the way that we think he should, the way that we anticipate in our culture. He doesn't bring this guy on a ministry tour. He doesn't hold him up as a trophy. He doesn't co-write a book saying they called him Legion with pictures and posters. And that's not what Jesus does. He doesn't seize the moment. He doesn't do that. He tells this man, go home. Tell your friends you've been changed. You know, there's something so refreshing about that. And for all the fireworks that begin in this text, it ends in an office building. This guy is just sent back to the office, back to the house, and Jesus is basically saying, when you get an opportunity, swivel your little office chair around, talk to the guy in the cubicle and say, have I told you about what God has done? Do you love how every day this is? Now we know God in his providence can, he's just the maestro of all things. And so we know if we read later on in this passage in verse 10, this guy's going to go to Decapolis. He's going to go to 10 cities where there are Gentiles everywhere. And in that way, he's going to be a kind of missionary to the Gentiles. But I don't think he knows that. He's just depressed because Jesus turned him away. I mean, he said he begged him. He begged Jesus, and Jesus didn't permit him. This didn't seem like a, you know, I'm not going to bring you with me, but do you realize you're going to an unreached part of the world? No, he's not doing any of that. He just sends this guy back home and just says, live it out and tell the story of what God has done in your heart and in your life. One commentator said this about the big picture of what God was doing in mission. Mark probably saw in the man the first missionary to the Gentiles and a preview of the Gentile mission that flourished during the quarter century before the writing of his gospel. But when it comes to this man's own personal life, he simply is sent by Jesus to go and talk to his friends and talk to his family and tell them the simple story of what God had done. What we say when we stand in just a moment at the end of our gatherings, when we recite the Great Commission, what we are saying to one another is nothing less than go home to your friends and tell them what Jesus has done for you. That's his call, for us to live and share and speak in a way that gives glory to the God who has saved us. This is our story. This is my story, made by God to know him, to enjoy him, and then sin twisted and distorted everything, and then Jesus came and he changed everything. Everything. It's my story. It's your story if you're a follower of Jesus. This is the story of the world. This is a biblical worldview. What was made good was twisted and distorted by the fall, and it will yet be renewed. The world was good. The world is fallen. The world will be redeemed. The world will be rescued through the proclamation of the gospel of this conquering king.